It's called presidential harassment.
I want nothing.
And it's unfortunate.
I want no quid pro quo.
This should never, ever happen to another president, ever.
I don't know. I haven't spoken to Rudy. I spoke to him yesterday briefly. He's a very good attorney, and he has been my attorney. Yeah, sure.
Shut up, Rudy.
Rudy.
Shut up.
Okay, hold on.
Shut up.
Hold on,
you don't know what you're talking about.
What they've done to General Flynn.
Russia, Russia, Russia.
What they've done to others.
It was all bull.
This is Josh Barrow, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers, the podcast about all of President Trump's legal issues. And Ken White is with me. Ken is my co-host, a criminal defense attorney and former federal prosecutor. He blogs at popehat.com. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Josh.
So when somebody's the president of the United States, the authority is total. That's what the president said at Monday's coronavirus press briefing. He was responding to questions about his stated intention to open the economy as soon as possible. So can he do that? Aren't state governments where the power lies to order and lift epidemic-related closures?
Absolutely. There's really no serious argument to the contrary. And even many of the people who are generally the president's biggest boosters conceded that he does not have the power to do that. It's the governors who have the power within the states to shut things down or open them again. The president at most might have the power to prevent some interstate travel. But Josh, it may be that President Trump's evaluation of his own power varies with the day of the week, because the next day he was back to saying that what he meant was that he had the power to authorize the states to reopen again, which really is very nice of him.
But does he have that power either? I mean, I guess the president can say to anybody, you know, you may do this, but the states don't need his authorization to open either.
They don't. I can authorize the sun to rise tomorrow, but I don't think it's going to be material to whether it happens or not. I think this was just sort of a walk back by the president as gracefully of as he's capable of something he said that was plainly incorrect.
So should we be looking beyond the president's actual legal authorities here? Because, I mean, obviously what the president says is important in terms that it influences what state governments do. It also influences what members of the public are willing to do in their own personal behavior and what they might pressure state and local governments to do. But then also the federal government has sort of increasingly over the last several decades interferes in the affairs of states and uses tools like federal spending to influence the policies that are made by state and local governments. So, I mean, for example, the president has authorized disaster declarations for every state in the country right now. Could the president use certain powers under federal laws? I mean, for example, could he revoke those declarations? Are there things that he could do that would seek to pressure the states to move in directions that he wants on infection control measures?
Absolutely, Josh. I mean, he can use the bully pulpit to try to convince the states to try to pressure the governors through public pressure to do what he wants. He can withhold or extend a wide variety of federal aid. He can direct various government entities to be more helpful to the states that cooperate and less to the states that don't. He can use federal stockpiles of various disaster-related items to try to get the states to go along. What he can't do is make orders about what people in the states can or can't do. He can't direct them to shut down or reopen.
But I guess the question is, how powerful are those powers that he has that aren't direct orders? I mean, you know, the federal government can't tell states what speed limits to put on interstate highways, but it very effectively controlled the policies that they made there by withholding highway funding from states that would not do that. So, I mean, in practice, the federal government seems to have significant ability to commandeer the policy-making power of states.
Well, sure. The question is, I think, how much he really wants to be controlling it or how much he wants to be seen as controlling it. So the governors are going to do what they're going to do. And I think a number of them have said fairly openly that if their calculus of what the risk is different than that of the administration, they're going to look out for the health and safety of their own people. They're going to go their own way. So what the president maybe want to do here is to be seen as guiding and leading, even if the measures he's using are not the things that are convincing the states to do something. He may want to be seen as getting out ahead of whatever they wind up doing anyway.
I guess the last thing to note about this is that we're largely talking about the activity of private entities, of individuals and of businesses. Now, obviously, there are significant components. State and local governments have closed their own operations. Federal government has closed certain operations. It could directly reopen those. But mostly, you're relying on private actors to agree to engage in private commerce. And neither the federal government nor state governments can force businesses to reopen in most cases, can't force customers to go shop in them, can't force people to go back to work. So everybody's ability to reopen the economy is limited, is significantly more limited in the than the government's ability to shut down the economy was, because you're depending on individuals to willingly go along with whatever is being recommended.
Absolutely. I don't think we should assume that businesses are going to move at the same speed as consumers. So you may have businesses just out of necessity, out of desperation to stay afloat, opening their doors long before individual people feel comfortable going out and using those businesses. And that's particularly true for places where people congregate in large numbers, whether it's a movie theater or a restaurant or a sports stadium.
Yeah. So let's talk about what we're seeing in some of the states, because we're seeing litigation in various places about some of these orders. In Kansas, the governor, Laura Kelly, who is a Democrat, had issued an order expanding the state's ban on in-person gatherings of 10 people or more. She expanded it to cover church services shortly before Easter. And Republicans who control the state's legislature took exception to that move. They purported to overturn her order, even though the legislature isn't actually meeting. They acted through a body called the Legislative Coordinating Council, which consists of certain senior leaders from the state legislature who may be available even when the legislature as a whole is not. And so because you had this conflict between the governor and an organ of the state's legislative branch, the Kansas Supreme Court got involved. They found that the governor's order stood. So first of all, one thing I found interesting about this case is the argument before the state Supreme Court was conducted over Zoom. And I watched part of the argument. It actually seemed to work really well for an appellate hearing anyway. You had each judge in his or her own little box, and they were able to interact well with each other and the lawyers. It certainly seemed like there's no reason that you can't do these sorts of appeals court activities via video conference.
I think that's right. And I think ironically, doing appellate court arguments by Zoom may wind up with fewer interruptions than doing it live might be, because appellate judges are notorious for interrupting you early and often. It did work well, as have a number of court hearings, both in the trial court and the appellate court, since this started. And I think it's something where this is something that may have some beneficial outcomes in the long term, as courts determine that now and then this is appropriate, particularly for emergency type situations.
So to talk about this specific Kansas case, there are two separate legal issues here. One of them I don't want to belabor too much. It has to do with whether the legislature had truly actually delegated its authority to this coordinating council, and the answer seemed to be no. When the court looked at the statute that created the Legislative Coordinating Council, it didn't seem to give authority to overturn this kind of order from the governor. But there's another issue which I think is more interesting, which wasn't actually addressed in this decision itself, which had more to do with the substance of the order, whether Kansas churches had a free exercise right to meet and worship even in spite of the epidemic. And obviously we're seeing similar arguments about similar restrictions around the country. And so one question is, did it matter that this rule in Kansas restricting in-person gatherings, it has exceptions for other kinds of entities. There are ways that retail stores can stay open. There are certain activities that schools can conduct. So the government can impose restrictions that apply to religious institutions, but it's not supposed to disfavor the religious institutions compared to other secular institutions. So do the churches have a case here saying, well, you know, if people can go to the Home Depot, then you have to allow them to go to church?
I think the churches have a very plausible case. Josh, I think you're blowing past the procedural argument too fast, though, because there's something very uniquely American about how we're in the middle of a historic pandemic. The issue before us is freedom of religion, the very thing that is at the foundation of our republic and the start of America. But what drives the decision is whether or not the right committee voted That's just so beautifully, uniquely American and legal that I love it. But turning to the substance, yes, it does make a difference whether or not there are exceptions. And that's because when you restrict a fundamental right, like the freedom to worship or the freedom of speech, that decision tends to be subjected to what's called strict scrutiny, the highest level of judicial scrutiny of whether or not the decision is justified. And strict scrutiny requires the government to show not just a compelling interest, and in a pandemic probably applies, but narrowly tailored means to get to that end. One of the things that judges frequently look at when applying strict scrutiny is the question of, are you doing this even-handedly? You say the interest is compelling. Well, are you then applying it evenly as if it's compelling? And even though the court in Kansas did not get to this, a trial court in Louisville did. And there, that was the very issue that this turned on. A federal judge, a recent Trump appointee, ruled in rather florid terms that a mayor's rule purporting to close churches while leaving open liquor stores did not survive strict scrutiny. Because, again, if you're going to shut things down, you can't shut down fundamental rights and leave open non-fundamental rights, like leaving open a liquor store or a Home Depot when you're shutting down a church. So I think that that would have been a serious argument that would have merited a real consideration if the Kansas court had gotten to the merits.
But these sorts of restrictions, they can survive in certain cases, even if there are exceptions for certain other kinds of institutions. It depends on the reasoning behind those exceptions, right? I guess this gets to the narrow tailoring. I mean, Eugene Volokh, who's a law professor at UCLA, had an interesting argument here, giving the example that battery is a crime. In general, you can't hit other people. But there are certain exceptions to that. Like if someone is running off with your property, you may be able to hit them in an effort to recover it. But just because there are exceptions for certain secular purposes doesn't mean that you also need to give an exception for religious purposes, that you don't have to make it legal to hit someone who blasphemed because you have a religious concern there, even though certain secular concerns create exceptions to the prohibition on battery. And so to go back to these sorts of public health orders, the case for liquor stores, for example, has to do with you have people who have alcohol dependencies who, if you cut off their ability to drink, they're going to go into medical distress and they're going to show up in ERs with withdrawal symptoms, which you want to avoid both because of the danger of that and because you don't want to be creating additional demands on ERs right now during this crisis. So that creates a public health rationale specifically for keeping liquor stores open. So does it depend on the reasoning for certain exceptions that either, there are good public health reasons that things need to be kept open, or there are certain kinds of measure that can be applied in certain places that negate the public health concern about keeping those open, that you can have those sorts of exceptions and still apply the general prohibition to certain kinds of religious activities?
Yes, all those go into the mix of the argument. It's just that when you're dealing with a fundamental right like freedom of worship, those arguments are going to be treated with more skepticism than they are with other types of regulations that don't implicate fundamental rights. So here, maybe one of the strongest arguments is that worship services involve large groups of people congregating closely, whereas you can run a business in a way that doesn't have that, whether it's your local store limiting the number of people who can go inside at any time to only being able to pick up takeout at the sidewalk, whatever that is. But those arguments are going to be treated much more rigorously and examined to say, is this really necessary, more so in the context of a fundamental right than in other contexts?
And so that judge you mentioned in that Louisville case, was he doing that? Was he doing that sort of careful weighing of those conditions?
It's hard to call it careful simply because the entire decision is so completely rhetorically incontinent. So this judge is Judge Justin Walker. He's only 38 years old. He was recently appointed to federal court in Kentucky. And what he wrote seemed like something you might see on InfoWars or The Federalist. It's full of extremely purple prose about the history of religious discrimination and the struggle against it in the world and in America. And it only gets down to the actual issues at hand towards the end, and then fairly briefly. But he does do the correct strict scrutiny analysis, and he points out that if it's permissible for the liquor stores to be open and to restrict who comes in at one time and to have people pick up at the curb, then they can't very well restrict churches from having drive-in services, which is what we were talking about here. The mayor allegedly purported to prohibit churches from having drive-in services where everyone comes up in their car and attends like a drive-in movie type worship service. And I think it's a perfectly plausible ruling by the judge, and so for that matter do a lot of First Amendment and free exercise scholars. It's just a little odd and off-putting, the extremity of the language he used to couch it. He seemed to be more preaching or making a political argument than a judicial decision.
You mentioned that you felt quite good about the video conference method of conducting these sorts of appellate hearings. I guess the Supreme Court is going to be doing not video conferences, it sounds like, but telephonic arguments for a number of cases, including some of the cases we follow on this show. The cases about President Trump's financial records, looks like those will be argued over the phone in May, in early May. That's a remarkable change for the Supreme Court, which has been so resistant both to technological advance and also to methods of conducting hearings that draw a lot of, you know, public ability to look inside. I mean, the Supreme Court does not have cameras. They don't have live audio of the arguments, sort of designed to avoid minute-to-minute coverage in the way that many other parts of the government are covered in a live manner.
Right. And they are doing it only one step at a time. It's important to note. They are not going full Zoom. No one's going to be observing by video the justices or the people arguing. With the Supreme Court, which is extremely tradition-bound, it's really one step at a time, and this is a step in the right direction.
Let's take a break, and when we come back, we will talk about a defamation lawsuit from the Trump campaign. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers. This is Josh Barrow, and I'm back with attorney Ken White on All the President's Lawyers. So the Trump campaign is suing a television station in northern Wisconsin for airing a TV ad against Trump from the Priorities USA Super PAC. The campaign says the ad is defamatory, that it takes Trump out of context about a hoax. The ad shows Trump calling something a hoax. They say the ad suggests that he's saying that the coronavirus itself is a hoax, and that what Trump really meant was that Democratic criticism of his handling of coronavirus is a hoax. We talked about this before, and you said that the argument that this ad is defamatory is extremely weak. So now that there's actually a lawsuit about that argument, what do you see a court doing with it?
I think it remains extremely weak. It's significant that, first of all, that they sued in Wisconsin, which does not have an anti-SLAPP statute. It's also significant that they sued only the television station, the local television station with relatively limited assets. They did not sue the super PAC. They're not bringing the big dogs into the fight. And those are signs both of the weakness of the argument, their intent to make it more really a act of political theater rather than a genuine legal fight, and perhaps a reluctance to go up against people who are better equipped to fight the issue. So, Josh, this type of theory, if you accepted it, would make a vast percentage of political advertising defamatory. Making an argumentative statement about how one should characterize a political opponent's statements is at the heart of politics. It may not be nice. We may wish that politics were different, but there it is, and it's, I think, silly to pretend otherwise. It's an opinion to say that the significance of Trump's statement was just a reasonable critique of Democrats or the media, or that it was actually what he felt at the time about coronavirus, that different people can take it different ways. It is by no stretch of the imagination a provable false statement of fact. It's more like, here's what he said. Isn't this guy ridiculous? And that's pure opinion.
I assume the strategy here is to discourage television stations from agreeing to carry this ad or other similar ads, that they don't want to bear the cost of this litigation, even if they would ultimately win it. And so this lawsuit, even though Priorities USA is not a party to the lawsuit, they conceivably are quite impacted by it. Do they have any recourse about that? I mean, could they intervene in this lawsuit in any way? Could they pay the television station's legal fees? And if Priorities sees that this station or other stations start refusing to carry their ads, could they sue the Trump campaign? Could they say, you know, is this like tortious interference or something, where the Trump campaign is interfering in the business dealings of this political action committee?
So they certainly could fund the defense, and so could any number of media organizations who see what the president's campaign is trying to do here. Generally, they can't sue on the theory that the Trump campaign is wrongly suing someplace else. You know, it's the right to petition the government includes the right to bring lawsuits, and the spectrum of situations where you could sue someone else for filing lawsuits is extremely narrow, with exceptions that simply don't apply here. So I think that the best way that the PAC can help out is with money and lawyers. And that's likely what they'll do. I don't know if the Trump campaign actually thinks that they will have a deterrent effect on other people running the ad. I mean, if anything, the lawsuit brings more attention to the ad as other outlets report on it and link it. It seems to me more staking out a political argument that the evil mainstream media and the Democrats are making misuse of an innocent quote by the president. Because, I mean, the quote does sound terrible right now as death rates rise. And even if the president was making the argument that it's the Democrats' approach to this that was the hoax, that sentiment seems very much as foolish and reckless as the sentiment that the pandemic is a hoax. So I think this is more political maneuvering and political argument than it is realistic legal strategy.
The problem with the money and lawyers approach is that, you know, if I owned a television station, I'd be really reluctant to be taking financial support for my legal costs from a political entity. You know, it sort of it gets you in the middle of a political fight between two parties at a time when, you know, you run a news operation and you're trying to get people to take you as an independent entity. And then it creates an appearance of being financially dependent on that political committee. So that makes me, you know, it makes me wonder about the deterrent effect of this, because, if you know, as you say, if you run a small station that's not very financially capitalized, you might not really have a great way. I guess I don't know how much is it going to cost a station to defend against a lawsuit like this?
A few hundred thousand dollars, Josh, easily, just to get it done very well through the phase of trying to get it dismissed. So. Yes, a lot of small stations can't absorb that type of cost. So the hope may be that First Amendment organizations and independent lawyers who do pro bono work will step up and help. Because sure, you're right that, you know, there's a problem with taking it straight from a super PAC or from a political party. So that may be an additional deterrent.
And then if you lay out that money, would you be able to recover? You mentioned that Wisconsin does not have an anti-SLAPP law, which is to say they don't have one of these laws that basically allows you to get frivolous defamation lawsuits thrown out quickly and to get attorney's fees paid by the person who filed it. Would the station, you know, you say this is a very weak lawsuit, could they expect to get any of their legal costs being covered in the end by the Trump campaign here? Or does the lack of that anti-SLAPP law mean that basically whoever paid those legal fees is out those legal fees?
They're probably out the legal fees, Josh. The bar for recovering fees outside the SLAPP statute is extremely high. You really have to show that it's so frivolous that it's sanctionable. Judges tend to be very reluctant to make that finding even when it's warranted. And so it's very unlikely that they recover their fees.
Finally, let's talk about Michael Avenatti, because Michael Avenatti is getting out of jail. And, you know, we've talked about a number of these petitions or, you know, motions brought by people, including Michael Cohen. Paul Manafort is now trying to get out of jail on the grounds that coronavirus is a significant risk for him. They want to move him to home confinement. But for Michael Avenatti, the argument has actually worked. So how is it that Michael Avenatti managed to get himself out of custody right now?
Well, I mean, he had a big team of lawyers willing to do a lot of work, and they just kept at it. So he kept going to the judge indicating that, you know, we're willing to put up $500,000. We're willing to have him live with his friend. We're willing to have all these restrictions on his travel. And, you know, frankly, when someone is in pretrial custody, and that's what this case really is, because remember that he got put in custody on the theory that he violated the terms of his bail in California in a case that hasn't happened yet. And judges should let you out if there is a combination of conditions that will assure that you will come back for trial and you won't be a danger to the community. The judge's determination, that was the case, for $500,000 in bail and being forced to live at somebody's house is not entirely unreasonable. But very few people would be able to afford that or afford the lawyers to successfully make the argument. But the restrictions he's facing are still pretty severe. The $500,000 in bail, he's been forbidden to use the internet, which I assume means that he's going to have to call me again to abuse me. And he has to live with a friend. He has to be cleared for the coronavirus by the Bureau of Prisons before he's released. And what I thought was the most absolutely bizarre part, his lawyers applied and the judges approved a very specific schedule by which one lawyer would pick him up and drive him to an airport in New York, another lawyer would accompany him on a flight, and a third specified lawyer would pick him up at LAX and drive him to a specified location. It's really kind of like a heist movie. I expect George Clooney and a team of ne'er-do-wells to show up to somehow spring him somewhere midway through this process. but it's remarkable. And to me, the part that upsets me the most is not that Michael Avenatti is getting out of pretrial custody. That's frankly a not unreasonable application of the law. It's that the vast majority of people out there do not have the resources to achieve this result.
There's much more to talk about, but I think that's a good place for us to leave it. Ken White, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Josh. Stay safe.
If you have questions about the president's lawyers and his legal issues, please send them to us. You can find us on Twitter at LRCKCRW. You can also leave us voicemail at 424-538-8888. All the President's Lawyers is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us. And Ken and I will be back next week with more All the President's Lawyers.